This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Welcome to CBS Eye on Veterans. I'm Navy veteran Phil Briggs, reporting for ConnectingVets.com. Our guest today is retired Navy SEAL Chief Eddie Gallagher. And for almost 20 years, Chief Gallagher served on the elite SEAL teams deploying 8 times to Africa, Afghanistan, and Iraq. It was on his last deployment that things got extremely violent as U.S. and Iraqi forces fought to clear the death grip ISIS had on the city of Mosul. And it was there that SEAL Team 7 began to turn against itself. And Gallagher would eventually be charged with murder. Murder of a terrorist. The story played out on national news several times. First, when Gallagher was suddenly arrested at a medical facility where he was receiving treatment for traumatic brain injuries, he was taken to a military brig and held in solitary confinement without being told what he'd been arrested for or how long he would be there. Gallagher would spend 9 months in prison, largely being denied medical treatment and access to his own legal team. The government traumatized his family, and the press vilified him as a monster. And once President Trump began tweeting about the case, well, it made it even more polarizing and drew even further media scrutiny. Even after a jury of his peers found him innocent of murdering an ISIS fighter, there still exists a perception that Chief Gallagher got away with murder and was pardoned by President Trump. I recently had a chance to talk with Chief Gallagher for an hour about his new book, The Man in the Arena, From Fighting ISIS to Fighting for My Freedom. During this interview, the chief doesn't hold back. Gallagher talks about his fellow SEAL Team platoon members that turned against him and conspired to frame him for war crimes, why the Naval Special Warfare leadership didn't back him up, and we even talk about exactly what happened that day, where they brought a half-dead terrorist to the SEAL compound for medical aid, and the grim photo of him posing with the body and a hunting knife. Whether you agree or disagree with what you've heard and read, this is a story where even the truth sounds crazier than fiction. Navy SEAL Chief retired Eddie Gallagher, welcome to Eye on Veterans. Great to have you, Chief.
Thank you. I thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, before we get into the book, The Man in the Arena, From Fighting ISIS to Fighting for My Freedom, I just wanted to let you personally know that I actually started preparing for this years ago. I spoke with Paul Zoldra of Task and Purpose. And he, as a witness, was the agent in charge with investigating this entire situation.
Correct. Yeah. So basically the gist of this case is that at least during or sometime after the deployment of these SEALs from SEAL Team 7, a number of SEALs inside Gallagher's platoon brought up allegations of war crimes.
He was attending the Article 32, which eventually led to the murder trial, the presidential tweets, the eventual acquittal of murder charges and war crimes, except for the picture, of course. One, I want to thank you for your time, and two, ask, you know, was writing a book about this something that you instantly wanted to do as you began this experience to kind of clear your name, or was this something that kind of creeped up as you processed what had happened after the acquittal?
It was definitely not something I wanted to do. It wasn't a decision I made right away, but I was advised by a lot of people that, you know, you should write the book, you should tell the story. A lot of good friends of mine were like, you know, this isn't just some normal, you know, story. This is this is insane. The story's crazy. There's a lot of twists and turns. So, and they said, you know, if you don't write the book, no one will know the truth. You know, the media had pretty much slandered me for 2 years, put out a bunch of misinformation and half truths as this thing was going on. And, there's really no recourse. You know, we filed, some IG complaints against the Navy once the trial was over because of all the, corruption and everything that had happened. And of course the Navy was like, nope, we didn't do anything wrong. Move on. So, you know, I decided, that's when I decided, I was like, you know what, I'm going to tell my side of the story, what me and my family went through, during this whole ordeal. And then also highlight the fact my wife and brother did during this whole thing, which is, I mean, they took on the media and the government, and won, you know, so, and that's no easy feat. That's, that took day in, day out work. And I can't express enough how much those two are heroes to me. So I wanted to highlight that in the book, and then also highlight the fact that I was demonized for wanting to do my job. The Navy prosecutors, and my command and NCIS, tried to demonize me as much as they could by saying, because I love to do my job and that I love to deploy and go fight overseas, that I was a warmonger and some kind of psychopath. Well, in demonizing me in that manner, then you are demonizing all of my brothers and sisters who've been fighting this war for the past 20 years, because, you know, we take pride in our country and we definitely want to go serve and we want to go deploy and we want to go defeat evil. That does not make us bad people. You shouldn't demonize us like that. I wanted to write the book in that way, and just be as transparent as possible, sort of give a brief overview of my career. You know, I don't spend a lot of time on stories about deployments and this and that, but more of so the fact of just how busy it is in the SEAL teams, how much you deploy, what the families go through. You know, my wife and kids served just as much as I did by holding down the home front. And so when they attacked me, you know, and tried to put me away for life, they were attacking my family. They were attacking my wife and kids. And, you know, that's where I draw the line. I always say, you know, the Navy or NSW could have punished me by myself alone, and done these things. And I think I would have been okay, because, you know, I was in the military, so you're sort of used to taking shit. But as soon as they had attacked my family, that was it for me. You know, they crossed a line that I'm not going to put up with. And so, we talk about it in the book. We call out everybody that was involved in the book by name. We put out exactly what happened. And, you know, and even the cool thing about it is, while I was writing the book, there's so much stuff that happened during this that I turned to my wife and I was like, you know, no one's going to believe this. There's so much corruption. So I wanted to be as transparent as possible. So I decided to put QR codes in the book. And basically, you, while you're reading it, you can go ahead and listen to all the trial audio. You can listen to all the NCIS interviews. You can see all the evidence. You can see the text messages of the people that accused me and the way they were conspiring all the way up until the trial. I mean, it's all there. And you're just going through, you know, if something sounds too crazy or be like, oh, that doesn't sound like that could happen, we put the QR codes and you can watch it yourself.
Yeah. In fact, looking through your website, we'll reference that a little bit later in this interview, but it's a trip, man. EddieGallagherBooks.com. You've actually got links to these guys testifying on the stand or their NCIS examinations. You know, the interrogations that they have before, you know, they go to trial. Wild. I've never seen a crime book with actual links to audio from testimony. Let's jump into the book. The book starts with you in the brig. Where were you again when they came and got you? Because I found this very, very interesting. You were, in fact, like working on being your best self. You were looking at retirement just a few blocks down the road. You were doing all the kind of post-deployment things that somebody does to just get their head right. But explain to me where you were when they came and said, Chief, need to speak with you. And the next thing, you're in handcuffs.
Yeah. So I had gone to a traumatic brain injury clinic. It's called Intrepid Spear. It's a branch off of NICO, but it pretty much operators go there, and not just operators, you know, everybody in the military can go there. If you have some kind of traumatic brain injury or have been around explosions, car accidents, whatnot. And so by the time I had went there, I was about 19 years into my career. I had not reported a lot of the stuff that had that my body had been through, you know, all the explosions, everything else that, that we deal with. So I wanted to go get, you know, myself treated and trying as much as possible before I get out, so I won't be a burden on my family. You know, so I went there and was definitely healing, going through the Intrepid Spear process. And about a week and a half into that, my command showed up, and they, I think I was in meditation at the time, and they came and told me to, you know, get up, and that they had to take me to prison. I had asked why. They could not give me a reason. They just said that the Admiral Green had signed off on it, and that I was ordered to go to prison. Again, no reason. You know, I had a choice at that point. I could have put up a fight, and, you know, thrown a fit, but then I knew that that wasn't going to help the matters any, that I knew how the military works. So I just sort of remained compliant. And really, I was thinking that somebody's going to see this as a big mistake and I'm not going to be in prison. You know, like they're going to come get me. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. Once you get thrown in that brig, which is military prison, you are not getting out, and all of your rights are taken away from you. And you're pretty much just another prisoner awaiting trial.
Mm. Except the details you put in the book, I did find fascinating that when you were being transferred, they didn't treat you like any other prisoner. I think you referenced one of them looked at you like Hannibal Lecter because they used about five times the amount of people to get you from point A to point B, afraid of this crazed Navy SEAL. And I mean, truth be told, you could probably wiggle out of any sort of restraint that, you know, some MP gives you that's yeah. never actually been trained the way you are.
Put a lot of emphasis that because I was a Navy SEAL, I was dangerous, but they definitely over-dramatized it on purpose to sort of create this narrative. I mean, I was pretty surprised on the way they were treating me when I showed up. You know, they had me shackled from head to toe, like I was Hannibal Lecter, but they also thought I was Jason Bourne and I was going to like escape somehow. You know, it was very eye-opening to see just, you know, the narrative that was put down to the prison before I got there to all the guards that I was this dangerous psychopath. And of course that's from the prosecutors and NCIS. And then I really got an eye-opening experience. I had a hearing in prison to see if I could get out. It's like a formality. And that's when they used my job against me. Every school that I've been to, every qualification that I've had was turned against me. They said that they could not in good conscience let me out of prison because I was a sniper, because I was a breacher, because I had gone to Sears school, because I had done, like, they pretty much used every qualification in the book and saying it was a bad thing, that I'm dangerous. And that's when I knew, I was like, this is completely backwards. You know, the blood, sweat, and tears I've given over the past 19 years to do good at my job, to, you know, constantly hold myself to a standard, were now bad things. And now they were using that to keep me in prison. It was pretty crazy to watch.
Now, simultaneously, your wife in the following chapter is talking about sort of things she'd observed in the community over the years. And there's the sewing circle, also the term hate train. But essentially, as a former enlisted guy myself, you know, I can attest to the fact that, like, when we sat around, you know, there were lieutenants we liked. There were lieutenant commanders we didn't like. I mean, I lost a camera one time covering a story about surfing where I almost drowned. And, you know, I had to go to captain's mess because I lost the camera. I mean, nobody cared that, you know, yeah. I almost drowned. They were mad that I lost the camera. So there were certain LTs or certain people in the chain of command that you just knew they were jerks. They didn't look out for the young enlisteds as we felt. But in this particular case, your wife talks about this hate train where people would sort of select somebody that they didn't like and just really pile on the crap. And I think it's at this point that this is where you're realizing now, after the deployment to Mosul, maybe 6 months, 7 months out from the end of that deployment, that there's this hate train going on and that people are really talking some serious smack. And it's more than just Chief Gallagher's a dick or Chief's too tough on us. Can you just kind of paint for us a little bit of the accusations that started sort of innocently and then ramped up to something just incredible, which ended up in a murder trial?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you said it, you know, a bitchin' sailor's a happy sailor. So it's on deployment, and it's common for every deployment. You know, they're about 6 or 7 months long. Near the end, guys are tired. They want to go home. They're disgruntled because, you know, we've been sitting wherever we're deployed at that amount of time. And usually, you know, there is a, we call it a hate train or, you know, a bitch session or a gossip circle. And a lot of the time the leadership gets blamed because they're the ones in charge. And it's happened on every deployment I've been on. You know, I've actually been one of the guys that's been bitching about the leadership multiple times. Except with these guys, they decided to take it a step too far, I guess. We had a meeting when we got back from deployment after I had heard all of the little rumors and stuff that they were starting. I pulled them all in, said, hey, let's clear the air. Let's get this all out in the open. You know, this isn't going to do good for anybody. You guys keep on spreading this hate and discontent. But, you know, after that, we had that meeting. And, you know, at the end, everyone sort of agreed to, like, or at least I thought, agreed to go on with their careers. And there was just a couple individuals in the platoon who really held on to that hate and discontent, and decided to press it even further. And what these guys did is managed to grab a couple other guys in the platoon to join their cause. And they started off with little rumors that I was dangerous, that I was too aggressive on deployment, that I had worked them too hard, that I was a thief, which that one really upset me because I had never been called a thief before. And that's the one I sort of confronted them on. I was like, I want to know what I stole from you guys. They literally could not come up with anything legitimate, except that I had taken a Red Bull out of a refrigerator 6 months prior that wasn't mine, which I couldn't confirm nor deny. It was very just petty, a lot of just petty complaints. And they went to the command with them. The command asked them for evidence that I had stolen, you know, or what I had stolen. Again, they could not produce anything. They just said that it was either they heard I stole something or somebody said I stole something. Again, no concrete evidence. So the command told them to move on, decompress from this deployment and move on. Again, they refused to. And about 4 months later, 4 or 5 months later, they came. Craig Miller, who was my LPO, went to the command and said, well, now we have something. He murdered a ISIS prisoner that we had. He stabbed him. So the command asked him, are you sure this happened? Yes. And he's like, okay, well then you guys have a duty to report this if this is what really happened to NCIS. Craig Miller reported it to NCIS, and that's where this thing really went off the rails. We got a corrupt NCIS agent named Joel Rapinski that was in charge of the case. He, once Craig Miller came to him, and people can watch this on the NCIS interview, he starts off the interview by saying, your name will never come out. Your face will never come out. What you say here will not come out. It's all going to be locked away. No one will ever hear this. So go ahead and say exactly what you want. This gave Craig Miller carte blanche to just say anything. And that's exactly what he did. He lied multiple times, you know. People can watch in the video. He's crying. It's very embarrassing to watch, especially as a Navy SEAL. You know, unfortunately, Joe Warpinski took advantage of these guys and really sent this case to where it ended up. He went around everybody, even my command, that I was guilty. They had all the evidence they needed, that there was a video of me doing such act, which was completely untrue. So the command bit off on it and then went around and told everybody that I was guilty. And it was just really a game of like telephone from there. You know, you got to think, like, it starts off at that small level. Well, then the command is going around telling everybody I'm guilty. Then these high officers are going up to the White House saying that there's a video saying that I'm guilty. And I mean, it really spread all the way to the Secretary of the Navy, or who ended up getting fired over the case because he was meddling in there, doing an unlawful command influence and also lying to the president. I mean, this thing really got way out of control. It's very embarrassing that this happened, especially from someone that's comes from, you know, the NSW, and I love the NSW. It's where I was, you know, I'm from, and it was just embarrassing to watch my community act in such a manner. And that's sort of like, I think people are always confused, or which I would be too. And like, how did these guys, how would SEALs turn in their own guy? Especially why would they lie? And I try to do my best in the book to explain it. You know, I really dig into some of their characters, just how they were. I mean, these guys were not your average SEALs. They were pretty weak.
Welcome back to CBS Eye on Veterans. I'm Navy veteran Phil Briggs, reporting for ConnectingVets.com. And today we're talking with retired Navy SEAL Chief Eddie Gallagher about his new book, The Man in the Arena, From Fighting ISIS to Fighting for My Freedom. The book documents his murder trial after his fellow SEAL Team 7 teammates accused him of killing a wounded fighter and various other war crimes. Gallagher was eventually found not guilty and also found open support for his case from President Trump. In this next segment, we'll talk about some of the grim details of the case and his assessment of his SEAL teammates who turned against him.
They did not want to be on that deployment. This is their first combat deployment. As soon as the bullets started flying, they automatically were like, this is not what I signed up for. I don't want to do this. Those words were verbalized on deployment, as well as I don't believe in this mission. We shouldn't be here. Those were also verbalized. So you got to think like these guys, and I had a hard time understanding it, but these guys had come in through the Obama era, and they came in with a completely different mindset than the rest of us have. Most of us have been in since 9/11, especially the leadership. So it's a very different mindset, a very different drive into why we're deploying, why we're fighting this evil. I think it sort of clashed, you know, it's like two generations clashing. And I think, you know, the book explains that as well.
Yeah. And in fact, your wife even references that early in the book when you guys are having drinks at a bar somewhere, I believe in Coronado, and there's all the pictures of all the fallen SEALs and how she even noted that your contemporaries on the teams have a different sort of feeling than you do about their conviction to give their life for you. And vice versa. So that's a fascinating detail that unfolds. It's crazy how it escalates from like, look, Chief's a jerk. He makes us work too hard. He takes us to dangerous positions. He's stealing snacks. He took a Red Bull. He went into, you know, my care package and took my favorite Cliff bar. I mean, those are all petty things. The killing of the ISIS fighter. I've seen that video. In fact, you probably know the one I'm talking about. Journalist Ali Jawad or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, dude's conducting an interview with this young man who's literally laying there in a hell of a ton of pain. He's been lit up.
He's dying.
He got caught in a coalition airstrike, shooting at the Iraqis, shooting at our teams. I mean, you know, he wasn't just passing by shopping for shoes that day. I mean, you know, he had a weapon, but he's laying there. And even the journalist is like quizzing him with the microphone.
قبل رمضان تشتغل وياهم؟ ها. ليه اشتغلت وياهم؟ جبروك لو انت باختيارك.
ابويا.
ها؟
ابويا كان يقتلني.
ابوك يقتل لك؟
يقول لا تروح وياهم.
ابوك ما يقبل غير؟
لا
عاد ليش رحت انت؟
انا قاعد امدح. يقولون طيبة. يقولوا لك عافية.
And then turns him over to you guys. Of course they turn over to the SEAL teams and take him to the FOB because he can receive medical attention there. You are a combat trained medic. The video stops and you're kind of over the guy.
Yep.
And, you know, this was covered in the Apple Podcasts, The Line. And I don't know if you're familiar with that as well, but.
Yep. They definitely covered it. They sort of put their own skew on it. And I know that the last episode of The Line, they came out with this bombshell thing, trying to dramatize it, which in all reality, we had brought that up in court before the trial, saying that this was all done, medical procedures to pretty much let him die peacefully, because the Iraqis, which they usually did, is they took the bodies and hacked them up in front of us or around the corner, tortured them in some way. So it was a very quick decision, you know, when they brought him in. You know, it wasn't at the FOB. We were still out in the field in a forward position. And they brought him to us. And there's another video that was presented when they actually brought him to us. And if people translate it, the Iraqis are saying, not in front of the Americans, not in front of the Americans. They which is what they were going to execute him. We decided, we're like, well, you know what? We'll treat him and let him go out peacefully. You know, we knew he was going to die. We weren't medevacing ISIS fighters back then. We weren't taking them back to take care of them. But this was just a decision made on the fly. It's like, hey, let's just treat him and then, you know, let him go out. So that's what we did. You know, I grabbed my med bag, started to assess him, and started treating him as needed. You know, the video, like you said, shuts off about 5 seconds in, and that was done on purpose. NCIS had all the video, and because there is a video of the whole, all the treatments by TC Byrne and his helmet cam. It just so happened when TC Byrne, who was on the side of the accusers, turned in his computer with all the video, he deleted all the rest of the scene. So it just showed me coming up with the med bag. It's very, very vindictive what they did. And we brought that up in trial. Why are there missing videos? We had the files. They're like, they've been deleted. Why can't we watch them? And the prosecutors, of course, had no answer. They didn't want us to watch them because they knew it would prove my innocence, that I did not stab this prisoner, that he died from, you know, well, he died from the Hellfire missiles that we shot into him, but then he died peacefully from the, after the medical treatments.
So how is it that, and this is again, all on your website, how is it that that one SEAL could have testified that he saw you, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe, yep, I heard audio from the court case where he says he saw you remove your hunting knife and stab the gentleman. And then there were others that said you were putting a crike in the neck to create an airway.
Yep.
Two radically different things, a stabbing motion to the chest versus, you know, I mean, a somewhat methodical procedure to create an airway there in the neck. Did that SEAL straight lie to your face in the courtroom?
He lied to the whole courtroom. He lied to the judge. He lied to the jury. He'd been lying all the way up until that point. And this is the funny thing. So that was Craig Miller, who was the my LPO, which is pretty much the second enlisted in command of the platoon. And what these, he wasn't a very smart individual and not a very strong leader. So the two guys below him, Dalton and DeLay, manipulated him into, you know, taking charge of this, this rumor, you know, or this lie and making it go somewhere. So by the time it reached court and they had to go to trial, Dalton and DeLay had backed out and said, oh, well, we're not going to say we saw it now because we didn't. And so Craig was sort of forced to take that on and be like, okay, then I'll say I saw it, except he completely screwed up. And this is what happens when you lie. You have no choice but to make bigger lies on top of that, further it goes. So by the time he took the stand, and this was like the big turning point for me in the court. Everyone thinks it's when the individual admitted to killing the ISIS fighter. No, this was the turning point, is when he said that I had plunged a knife into the guy's neck and the blood was spurting out like baby vomit. He had never said anything like that before. He completely made that up on the stand. And honestly, the picture of me holding the ISIS fighter with the knife is the best and worst piece of evidence we have. You know, it's the worst because it doesn't look good, but it's the best because there is no blood anywhere on me. There's no blood on the knife. They did DNA tests on all my stuff, could not find anything. So his, you know, lie at that point was that, you know, blood was spurting out, just completely annihilated his whole case, like his whole story. These guys blatantly lied. You know, they committed perjury, but the thing is, her prosecution gave them all full immunity before they went and testified, knowing that they were going to lie, knowing that they were going to, you know, perjure themselves so that they wouldn't get in any trouble.
Mm. And that's got to be something unique to military court versus civilian court, because
military court, it's not uncommon. This is how the military court works. It's how the UCMJ, it's a very broken system. It's corrupt. And then it's all about getting a win. They do not care about the service member. They do not care about the individual. They are just looking for that percentage, that 90-some% prosecution rate.
Hmm. My captain's masts were never for these kinds of stakes, but I can say that I always felt, though, they didn't give me enough of a chance to present any evidence myself.
Also, as you know, if you do show up to an NJP board, to a captain's mast, or to a court martial, you will be punished on something. You are going to be punished just for showing up there. You could be completely innocent. And just, you know, they got me on the picture, you know, which is literally conduct on becoming a sailor is the charge, right? So they knew like that was a BS charge. They were trying to get me on murder. And then once I was found innocent of that, they really threw the book at me for conduct unbecoming, sentenced me to 4 months more in prison, which they, you know, I'd already served 2.5 times that. And they tried to take away my rank, my bust me down to E1, take away my retirement. I mean, it really was just a ego driven and just very childish of the Navy to act in that manner.
Let me ask about the picture if I can. Just because I think it's the one thing that so many people know and kind of associate with this story, even if they don't know the details as we've covered thus far. But did you ever regret that moment of the picture, with the caption and the sharing it among friends and the tweets and everything, or the text messages? Did you ever regret the photo of standing there
with the dead body of a terrorist in your hands and the caption, "Got him with my hunting knife"?
Yeah, I mean, I regret the fact that I sent that photo to a buddy. I regret that the fact that because I took that photo, my family was taken out at gunpoint. My kids were taken out at gunpoint, and my family was terrorized. You know, but at the same time, I don't regret the fact of taking the photo. Like, I don't care about that dude. I don't care what it looks like. You know, it's a you're in a different mindset over there. And I can honestly say, like, the way I think about it now and the way I think about it when I'm over there in the midst of it is completely different. You know, you're in a different, like I said, mindset. And, you know, that was a very chaotic deployment. There was dead bodies all over the place. I mean, seeing dead women and children on a daily basis, it just, you sort of get numb to it. And then, yeah, when you do kill the enemy up close, or when you do like have them, you do feel pride in taking, because they're evil. You don't look at them as human beings. They're just straight evil, especially after what you see they do to the civilians over there. And I don't think Americans know or want to know exactly what they do, but I can tell you that it's definitely the definition of evil. So yeah, I regret definitely sending the picture to a buddy. But as far as, you know, the pictures that were taken, you know, it happened, man. And I don't regret killing that dude, or like us killing that guy with Hellfire missiles, or all of his buddies. I mean, I think that's what we were over there to do. And we just took pride in it that day and probably celebrated in a way we shouldn't have.
And I've heard from my colleagues, I've got SF colleagues, former Rangers I've talked to other operators. And I know, I forget who said it, but a battalion guy told me, we're one jilted ex-wife and a computer hard drive away from seeing like a lot of things that show that this is not an uncommon situation. And that because of the technology that we're in, the 2000s, the factors GoPros on helmets, even the end of deployment videos, you know, probably include some unsavory images that I don't think the general public is ready to view, but are part of the gray area that is combat. And you know, it's easy on paper to say they go get the bad guys, but what that actually looks like in full color in three-dimensional GoPro video is just pretty nasty. And I don't think a lot of us have the stomach for it. Hey, chapter 38 talks about Trump's tweet, and it was the first of several. It's responsible for you being released from the jail cell confinement in the brig to a more relaxed confinement where you could, of course, meet with your attorneys and everything. I've always wondered this. How did the president even initially get involved? Was it just his voracious appetite for reading the news and seeing it on Twitter like you and me, or did Andrea, or was somebody had a way to get to President Trump after you'd been incarcerated now for a few months?
No. So my wife, as soon as they had locked me up, she started a grassroots organic campaign on social media to put out the truth about what was really going on. She started telling people that I was in prison for no reason, which was the truth, and that they were taking, you know, and then they were denying me my medical visits. They were denying me my lawyer visits. pretty much taken everything away from me. So she started this Instagram grassroots campaign and got a lot of followers, a lot of people listening to the story. And then my brother at the same time, who had prior experience on Capitol Hill, was going down there, knocking down doors of Congress, trying to get people to pay attention to what was going on, which was harder than he thought it would be. But eventually my wife got on Fox and Friends to talk about what was going on. And she knew that the president avidly watched that show every morning. She pretty much got on there and did her plight about, you know, what was going on to me and that we needed help. It wasn't until she got her, my brother got 50 congressmen to sign a petition to let me out of the brig so I could properly defend myself. And that's when the president got involved. He sent out a tweet saying, let him out of prison so he can properly defend himself. And I think this is where people are confused. He wasn't saying I was guilty or not guilty. He was just letting me have my due process. He was like, let this guy defend himself before trial. Because of the hatred for the president at the time by half the country, that sort of turned my case into now everybody, even if they didn't know about my case, now I was evil because they thought the president was evil. Now I'm evil. And it became a lot more contentious. I was gladly willing to take that on. I was more than grateful for what the president had done. It definitely helped us out. You know, I was able to see my lawyers just a little bit more. But what people don't know is when they released me from prison, the command, the Commodore at the time, Rosenblum, who avidly hated, he was a staunch anti-Trumper, was ticked that the president had ordered me out of the brig. So he ordered me to be confined in a barracks room with even more constrictions. I had less rights than I did in the brig. So I could not leave that room. I could not have a TV, telephone. I had to be in uniform. I was not allowed to walk anywhere without escort. And I still was not allowed to talk to my lawyers. So that was still, we were still fighting for my rights at that point. And it wasn't until the prosecution got caught spying on my lawyers and on the media to where the remedy for that, which, I mean, if it was civilian court, the case would have been thrown out and that prosecutor would have been thrown in prison. But since it's the UCMJ, the remedy for that is they let me out of confinement. And that was probably about a month before my trial.
Mm. And I'm glad you brought up the part about the spying, because I couldn't believe that when that made news, that at the same time you were, you know, being released to what sounded like more comfortable confinement, although hearing from you, it doesn't sound that comfortable. But then to hear that they were listening into phone calls or things of that nature, you get into that in chapter 52 or 53 there. And then that carries us for about 10, 12 more chapters up until 65, where you go through the trial. Quickly, just want to ask, you weren't a staunch Trump supporter. You weren't politically active before any of this went down, right?
Not at all. No, when you're in the military, I just remained, it was unpolitical. I mean, I just didn't pay attention to what was going on because I was going to be told what to do regardless and go fight where I needed to fight. You do notice a difference when you're in the military between the administrations on who actually cares about the military and who doesn't. And I voted for Trump when he ran, but I definitely wasn't out there being vocal or, you know, this is who I'm voting for. It was just, you know, I liked him. I was behind how he presented things. I liked that he spoke his mind, that he wasn't a politician. And so, yeah, I voted for him. And then I find it pretty interesting that, you know, now this happened to me and then he got involved, which, you know, thank God he was the president at the time, because I can tell you with the current administration we have now or the previous one before President Trump, that they wouldn't have paid, you know, attention at all.
Mm. Okay. Now moving forward, you go from chapter 53 to the early 60s there about the trial itself, and you break down some of the things you've already mentioned, the analysis of the picture, the fact that the video stops short. There was one part of the trial where they said that, as a sniper, you were too heavy-handed, that you would often go after non-combatants. And in particular, someone describes a shot from some position across a river, I believe. And mm-hmm. during the trial, I believe it was a witness for the prosecution actually said that he was the one that took the shot. Is that what gets us into the chapter Warpinski gets shelled? Was that that damning evidence where their own witness basically shot a hole in their boat?
Well, I mean, that happened multiple times during this trial, that where the prosecution's own witness, you know, pretty much shattered their case for them. You know, you had Corey Scott admitting to killing the ISIS prisoner, and then you had Dalton and DeLay, who both tried to collude with the story that I had shot a non-combatant, and that they had both witnessed it, except that when on trial, they were not, and I knew they were going to say this beforehand, they were not in the same building as me. They were about 250 yards away, and that they did not see me pull the trigger. They actually don't know if I shot, but the delay then, just like Craig Miller, made up some more stuff on the stand saying that he saw vapor trails out of nowhere. And that when he said that, you know, I even looked over at the jury when he said that, which was full of Marines that had been to combat. They all were very confused and perplexed by, you know, that statement. And it just showed, you know, he was there grasping at straws. It showed that they had no idea what they were talking about. And then, yes, there was another witness that got up there and said, I actually was with Eddie when he shot said individual, and that person was ISIS. That came out. Of course, the media didn't report that at all. There was people that came and testified for me that completely negated exactly what these guys were saying. Guys from the platoon that came up and said these guys were lying. All of that was not reported during my trial.
Mind blowing. Of course, the trial ends and you are acquitted, and President Trumpkin gets involved because, you know, that's where you get into the chapter. I believe it's prosecution's over, but the persecution continues. President Trump again had to get involved, maintain your trident and to keep you from being demoted. Talk to me a little bit about the persecution. And this is, you know, maybe where you can answer for Andrea too, because I know it wasn't just you that felt persecuted here. This affected your whole family. Share with me a little bit about that chapter.
Sure. So, I mean, you got to think that the Navy had put all this time and money into trying to put me away for life. I mean, they got the media involved. There was collusion with the media, and, you know, we have all the evidence on that, which is why we're in a lawsuit with the Navy right now. But because they had lost the trial and they took it as a big embarrassment, they then continued to come after me after the trial. You know, they, like I said, they were trying to take away my retirement, pretty much like my 20 years never existed, and they were just going to kick me to the curb. We were not taking that. So we were fighting back on that. The command, and it's the Naval Special Warfare Command, which, was Admiral Green and Master Chief Harley at the time, had banned me from all the SEAL teams, saying that I was not allowed anywhere near them. They had me checking in at some supply building down the street. And every day it was like a different game. I'd show up. They would tell me to go move all my gear to one place to another. It was all for no reason. It was all just to get me to do something. You know, I just kept my cool the whole time. And then it wasn't until the president had called me and said that, hey, I'm going to let you retire with everything you earned over the past 20 years. He did not pardon me. He just said, you will retire with this rank of chief with everything you've earned. You know, this is all a mess. And he knew more about my case than I think most people did. He really delved into it. He knew all about the lies and corruption and deceit because he has gone through obviously similar situation. So I think he really, he found a similarity.
Yeah.
So when he got involved and said, hey, you can retire. Then the Navy came after me the next day, this is actually pretty interesting. I did a Fox News interview the day the president had called me just to talk about what we talked about on the phone. And I was talking to Pete Hegseth, and at the end of that conversation, before we aired off, I was like, I am expecting full repercussions from my command for this. And Pete, you know, was like, oh, I can't believe you said that. And sure enough, the next day I go into work and they said, nope, now we're going to take your trident. Now we're going to do this to you. And so it just kept going. I mean, the ego of the Navy is, you know, pretty big. They're not going to admit that when they made a mistake. And it's pretty sad that they're willing to just keep pushing forward to hang one person out to dry to make, you know, even if they're in the wrong, they're doing it to make a point that you don't mess with the institution. I think we prove that the institution is not as strong as they think it is, and that you do have a voice and you do fight. You can fight back. These officers that are in charge are just human beings. Their rank means nothing. They literally are just people that stayed in the military long enough to pick up that rank, and now they can make decisions that impact not only service members but their families as well. And you have to stand up and fight back against that, which is what we did.
Right on. As we close, just wanted to bring up a couple things, man. I heard a great podcast with you and Andy over on the Cleared Hot, the podcast.
Yeah.
Love Andy Stumpf, man. That dude's awesome. You had said that you'd been going through a lot of therapy kind of after this, as you're writing the book. And in one line during the interview, you said that early in the SEAL team days, you know, you didn't process a lot of stuff. You just kind of, you know, stick it deep down inside. And I mean, it's probably not exclusive to SEALs, right? I mean, it's men.
Yeah, it's men.
It's a lot of us on Earth. I mean, we just don't like dealing with the nasty of life, so we lock it away. And we just think it's not going to go anywhere. It's just going to be there. But you had said something I found very interesting. When you thought about your fallen brothers, that oftentimes you would think of them on the following deployment and you would go for vengeance. And I'm thinking, is that a mindset that could lead people to believe that a more senior person on a special operations team has the bloodthirst because they've gone to multiple deployments now at this point, and they're angry over things that the younger, greener guys haven't experienced?
I mean, it depends on what context you take it in. I mean, when I'm saying, you know, I didn't process my brother's funeral, you know, deaths the same way that I would do now. Then I just use it as fuel to want to go back and keep fighting, and just keep defeating evil. And that was, the mindset I had. I was like, these people they didn't die in vain. Really, they died for a righteous cause, and I'm going to continue to, further that cause, which is get rid the world of evil. And if you want to, call vengeance, or which is, that's the word we used back in the day, especially after 9/11. You know, this is vengeance. So, like, here's payback for what you did to our country. And it's the same mentality that I have every time one of my brothers died over there. It's like, okay, well then, you took one of us out, now we're going to take 10 of you out. You know, that's the mindset. And I don't think it's definitely not the healthiest way to process it, but that is the way I processed it through my career. And, I've had to deal with that over the past year, as far as just dealing with the actual, everything I've shoved down, all the feelings that I've shoved down, emotions, that bench, when you get out, those places, it has nowhere to go but come out, right? So you have to learn how to deal with that, which is what I did this past year, which, it was huge for me.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there should be a cap or a limit on the amount of times that operators can deploy? I mean, heck, let's just even say across the entire infantry. I mean, should there be a cap about the amount of times you have to go and stand in front of the ugliness that is war?
That's a hard question, man, because, everybody's different. You can take one guy, he goes on one combat deployment and that's it for him. He can't take anymore. He can't process it. Then I have friends that are on 13 combat deployments and they're seem to be doing fine. But the one truth is, like, if you touch war, it's going to touch you back. You are going to have to deal with it. Whether you deployed once or 14 times, eventually you're going to have to, like, sit down with yourself and really process everything that you had done. I do think that they need to do a better job of watching over the soldiers, Marines, SEALs, special operators that go and do deploy. They need to do a better job of treating those guys as they're deploying. I think that, they should have better options, especially for, healing TBI or dealing with those things. And then, the big thing I think they need to work on is before you retire, before you go through transition, they should have a list of treatments and say, hey, here's the treatment before you get out. You will do 3 or 4 of these. pick them and force it on them to actually have to go do those treatments a year out. The problem is, as you know, the military is a big machine and it'll just keep turning and it'll use you to the very last end. So the day before you get out and they're like, well, see ya. And then you're on your own to figure it out. And that's what I've seen since I've gotten out. I've seen a lot of my friends who struggle after they get out. It's not uncommon for guys in the military or women to, when they get out, to struggle. And I would definitely, that's like a huge thing that we're taking on, especially with our nonprofit, the Pipe Hitter Foundation. That's going to be a pillar that's added on as to helping guys transition. And, you know, I give the guys the same advice when they're about to transition as I do to guys about if they want to go to BUDS, and that's just don't quit. It's going to be hard. It's not an easy thing, but you're going to have to work through it and just don't quit. There's going to be highs and lows, just like, you know, when we were going through BUDS and everything else, but you know, you just got to keep your head on straight and push through it and be open and vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. To which you've done some work with that. And I was interested also to hear on Andy's podcast with you about the hyperbaric oxygen chamber. How many times did you do that? Because I've reported on that before from Andrew Marr's book and that film, A Quiet Explosions, that came out last summer. Share with me what the hyperbaric oxygen chamber was like and what it did for you.
So I actually found a place here in Destin, Dr. Van Zandt. He owns the hyperbaric oxygen chamber therapy place. He has about 4 beds. It's not cheap. So Debbie Lee from the Mighty Warriors Foundation helped us pay for the treatments. And I did about 65 of those, did 2 a day. So you pretty much go there, you get inside the chamber for an hour at a time. They just take you down, I want to say, to like 15 feet. It might be another, you know, a different distance. I can't remember. And you pretty much sit there for an hour and just chill. It's supposed to, you know, that air, when you go down to depth, is supposed to help heal parts of your body and brain. I don't know the exact science behind it, but I definitely noticed a difference when I was doing it. I more noticed a difference when I was done. So while I was doing it, I was like, this isn't doing anything. I don't feel anything. But it wasn't until about a week after the treatments, I noticed, I was like, oh, I'm definitely more clear-headed. I don't have this fog over me. I felt healthier physically as well. I definitely recommend it. It's done wonders. I actually sent my dad down there because he was displaying early signs of Alzheimer's. And so we got him a bunch of treatments and it did wonders for him as well. We saw huge marked improvements.
Yeah. And in my previous reporting, from what I understand too, it's just something about like, it decreases inflammation in the body, and inflammation can be such a killer, whether it's an autoimmune issue or whether it's a pinched nerve issue. You guys, especially, you know, with all the stuff you've had to carry, I'm sure have so many pinched nerves. It's a miracle you get out of bed every day. Also, I read about a 10-hour trip in Mexico. Psychedelic. What is it again?
Ibogaine.
Yeah. Share with me that, because you and Andy talked about that. And I thought that was, for lack of a better word, a trip, a 10-hour, session where you get a little bit chemically inspired there and then you roll for hours.
So I have a good buddy, Marcus Capone. So Marcus and Amber Capone, he was a SEAL. He had gotten out years before me and was struggling. And you can actually hear his story on the latest Sean Ryan podcast. He goes 4 hours into it, but he was struggling. Him and his wife were at their wit's end. She's actually the one who found this treatment and begged him to go try it. He did, came back a changed person, like completely changed his life. I think the first thing he said, he's like, this needs to be done for other guys. Like if other guys don't know about this, they need to do it. So they started the vets program, and they pretty much take guys, special operators down there and go through this treatment. My wife and, you know, obviously I knew Marcus and I've talked to numerous people that had gone and done the treatment. So my wife and I decided that it would be definitely a good thing to do, especially after seeing all of the marked improvements from all of our buddies that have gone through it. So yeah, I decided to go do it. I went down there. It was you know, I was definitely nervous because I heard it was a very intense. It's the strongest psychedelic you can do. It's way stronger than ayahuasca. They call it the nuclear dose. It's pretty much the strongest dose you can get. And they realize that for special operators, that's exactly what they need. You know, we're not going to go to 3 years of therapy, intense therapy, and get everything out. This is pretty much 3 years of intense therapy in 10 hours. You take it, everything is treated with reverence. You know, they have a shaman there, they have doctors, they hook you up to an EKG. I have other SEALs there that have been through it that are watching over you. You take the two capsules, you put on a blindfold, like a sleeping mask, and just lay down and wait for it to pretty much kick in. And, you know, it's different for everybody. I had a very different experience than the three other guys I was there with. But it pretty much took me to the beginning of my life. And I watched myself as a baby and all the way up till now. And you can sort of delve into certain areas of your life. And what it really does is it cleanses you of all the trauma that you've had since childhood to now. And, you know, it makes you, everything that we've talked about that you have stuffed down and like, oh, I'm not going to think about that. It brings it right in front of you. And it's like, you will deal with this. And you come out of it with, I felt like a weight was lifted off me. I felt like I had clarity on a lot of things. And, you know, from that point on, it's, you know, it's work. It's still work. You still have to, you know, deal with some stuff, but it sort of gives you a platform. You'd be like, okay, this is how I should feel. This is how, you know, I should feel about this.
So cool. And I'm so glad to hear you share some of these alternative modalities, because
I'm all about it, man. Anything to keep people off the meds, this is the healthier alternative. I know it's like, I think it scares people because it has, you know, psychedelics attached to it and it's sort of taboo, but you know, it comes from the earth and we've been using it for years, thousands of years. I mean, yeah. And so, I mean, it works. And if it keeps you up, you know, big pharma, then I'm all about it.
And it beats this, because I'm here to tell you, post heart attack and post pinched nerve in my neck. And, right now I'm taking about, I don't know, like 5 or 6 different medications. That's my ritual, de la habitual. Yeah. I'm ready to try all kinds of things. Last thing I wanted to touch on, and that is probably the most important thing, but I noticed at the very beginning of the book, your wife's listening to a podcast about the story of Joseph.
Yeah.
And an amazing kind of parallel to what actually unfolded in your real life. How important is God in your life, and how does your faith work into your daily life?
God is the most important thing in my life. It's what has gotten me to this point in my life. You know, he's definitely the center of our family. You know, we're a very faithful family, faith-based. We try to live as good Christians. That is the one force that got us through this whole mess. I put that in my book, exactly the, you know, when I felt God take the weight off me, when I was in prison and I gave everything to him. And I'm telling you, I can't stress it enough that he has a plan for all of us. And sometimes that plan might not be your plan, but, you just have to put all your trust and faith in him and he's going to get you through it. And that's pretty much what I had to do. I had to give all my faith and trust in him in a prison cell. And he took that from me and guided me through. I'm not saying it was, you know, peaches and cream the whole time, but, it definitely, I felt his presence along with me the whole way. And, you know, and God has blessed us, you know, and that's the other thing is, you know, this whole thing was, as much as it was a nightmare as it was a blessing as well. You know, it gave us a platform afterwards to help other people. Which is why we started the nonprofit, the Pipe Hitter Foundation. That's what they, you know, there's that saying, you know, what they mean for evil, God means for good. It's that's exactly what this is. You know, they tried to put me away for life. You know, we fought back, we won. And then now we're going to use the platform we have now to help other people that are caught in similar situations.
In so much of Jesus's teachings, there's the part about forgiveness. Is that something you still work to reconcile? Is that something that you still kind of have to work with a lot?
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's one thing to say, oh yeah, I forgive them, but you know, deep down inside, you still have the emotions and the, you know, exactly. And it's very hard, especially when I think of what these guys did and what it caused to, you know, to my family. That's, like I said, that's a line that, you don't cross with me, but, I'm definitely, you know, every day just working on trying to forgive, working on trying to move past it. You know, so we'll see.
And to that, we are all works in progress, brother. Myself, I'm getting baptized actually at the end of the week. This is why I was
congratulations.
Yeah, I was really excited to ask you that question at the end because it just, we're never done. We're never finished. We are all constant works in progress. And I salute you going through everything you have and in the context of being open enough to share your faith. That's a huge step. You're also helping the next generation through the Pipe Hitter Foundation. I'm assuming this isn't about cannabis. Share with me a little bit about what the Pipe Hitters, about what the foundation does.
Sure. Pipe Hitter Foundation, you know, we named it that because, you know, in the military or law enforcement or whatever, usually if you're asking about somebody and they're like, oh, that guy's a pipe hitter, then that's usually the guy you want with you. You know, that's a good compliment. So we started this foundation after, you know, everything that we went through, you know, not when I was locked up, I met a lot of people in that brig that don't belong there. A lot of people in that prison that, you know, that didn't have an Andrea Gallagher to stand up and fight for them while they were dealing with all this, that didn't have a Sean Gallagher. You know, not everybody has a strong wife or a wife that's willing to speak up and fight back. So we decided to step in and be like, we will be that voice for you. So pretty much what the Pipe Hitter Foundation does is we take on active duty, law enforcement and first responders. If they're being unjustly accused or going through the corrupt system that we did, we will review your case. And if we give it a thumbs up, like, yes, we will help you, then we will provide legal funds for your defense. We also provide emergency relief funds to the family as they're going through the stressful time. And then we will publicly advocate for you if you want it. We also have, you know, we do not give lawyers. We don't have lawyers as part of our board, but we do have a list of lawyers that are vetted that are good that you can choose from, but that's on the person themselves to pick out their lawyer. And then, like I said, we're adding a pillar on for the mental health aspect as far as, you know, taking care of the guys and the girls as, it, you know, as they go through this and then when they're through it. Because as I witnessed firsthand, you know, there are repercussions from going through a stressful time like that. And you definitely need help on the back end.
Right on. Well, I really appreciate it. The book is a thrilling read. Just out this week, The Man in the Arena, From Fighting ISIS to Fighting for My Freedom, retired Navy SEAL Chief Eddie Gallagher. Thank you, brother. Really been good getting to know you, having this phone conversation. Like I said, something I waited the last couple of years to do. And your 2 cents spends like a dollar here.
I appreciate that, brother. Thank you, man.
All right, so that does it for this week's show. Thank you for listening. Now, we'd love to hear from you, so follow us on Twitter at IonVeterans, or you can reach me at PhilBriggsVet. I'm always down to get your hot takes and spicy memes, and I'd love to talk to you every week, so please like and subscribe. Hell, even give us a review of the show, because the comments and reviews really help us tailor the show to you. Again, I'm Phil Briggs, Navy veteran and reporter with ConnectingVets.com in Washington, D.C. And I look forward to talking to you again on another episode of CBS Audio's Eye on Veterans.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.